Hello and welcome to the Being Well podcast. I'm Forrest Hansen. Last week we finished The Strength of Aspiration, and today we're beginning the final strength in our year-long series, Generosity. At first glance, generosity may not seem like a mental resource, but it strengthens you with a sense of the fullness that's already inside, while also connecting you with other people. Generosity to others can be a gift to you along the way, giving you even more to offer in a positive cycle. Over this last year, we've explored many ways to fill up your own cup, which gives you more that you can place in the cups and the hands and hearts of others. Today, we're going to talk about generosity generally, and in particular, explore how to recognize and expand generosity in daily life. So I'm joined today, as usual, by Dr. Rick Hansen. And in the book Resilient, which we wrote together, you refer to everyday giving as a way to frame our natural expressions of generosity. Could you explain this to people and kind of what you mean by that phrase?
Well, as usual, the strengths at first hearing might sound lofty and kind of out of reach and airy-fairy. But in fact, they're really down to earth. And so one way to ground the strength of generosity is to think about how many times in a typical day you actually give something to other people without any thought of return. Mm-hmm. In other words, generosity essentially is altruism. So if we go to work and we do a good job, that's great. But at the end of the day or week or month, we expect a paycheck. Mm-hmm. There's an exchange there. Generosity is relevant when there's no exchange, or there's certainly no exchange in the near term. So it's helpful to appreciate how many times a day you offer the generosity of a smile. And you're not trying to manipulate other people to smile back. You just feel warm toward them. Mm-hmm. Or you let somebody else go in front of you, or you're restrained in some way. That's mm-hmm. generosity. So it's a good place to start to think about your everyday giving to ground this topic. Second, doing that can really help you appreciate and feel rewarded by and use it as a way into well-being to appreciate actually how giving you really are. Mm. I think many people sort of regard themselves as scrunched up, kind of sort of mediocre, if not bad people. Mm. And rather than really appreciating what a giving, good-hearted, generous, loving, benefiting person you really are. So recognizing some of the everyday giving you do is a nice way to tap into that good feeling about yourself.
Great. So I've always found it poetic or elegant how like the first 11 strengths that we focused on here and that were created in the course of the initial program that you created were really developed around this idea of like filling yourself up.
Yeah.
And they were kind of very internally and inwardly directed. I mean, of course, all of them can be used in relationship with others.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the goal is doing something inside of yourself. Whereas the final one, generosity, of course, is outward in nature. It benefits others. And we've talked a lot on this podcast about the evolution of the brain and each of the various strengths in terms of the evolution of the brain and kind of how it came to be. And of all these strengths, this is the one that most kind of doesn't obviously fit for me about why it evolved or developed inside of us. Because particularly in really harsh conditions, which you've said many times, are what our ancient ancestors, whether that be early humans or the, you know, animals that preceded early humans, grew up in. Giving something to somebody else without the expectation of receiving something in return does not really seem like a great survival strategy to me. Mm. So I'm sort of wondering, why is it that generosity came to develop in humans as a trait?
It's a deep question that has preoccupied people for as long as we have any kind of historical record, going back roughly 5,000 years. And it certainly has preoccupied social scientists in the last several decades. And it gets at a deep question of what is human nature fundamentally? And this overlaps a fair amount of religion and philosophy. And now scientists increasingly are addressing this fundamental question. What is our human nature? And you and I have certainly talked about the wolf of hate, as it were, metaphorically speaking, in people's hearts and the ways in which, as tribal beings, we're very vulnerable to appeals, to grievance and vengeance and fear, particularly when they come from authoritarian leaders. So on the one hand, we have that nature. Clearly, if you look at human history, or you look at the headlines today, it's very clear that part of human nature is a capacity for cruelty, dehumanization, prejudice, and war. On the other hand, the bulk of human activities on any given day, on average, are highly cooperative and in the near term do not involve an immediate exchange of getting back from others of our species what we are giving to them. And it's really remarkable to appreciate the degree to which that Homo sapiens, as it were, the clever ape, could also be described as Homo cooperativus. In other words, many scientists now feel that the fundamental adaptation that occurred over the last several million years, embedded basically in our DNA, our recent DNA, and certainly in our own brain as it tripled in volume in the last several million years, the fundamental human adaptation is not so much standing upright and walking about, which is important. It's not so much being able to detect color vision more effectively. It's being able to work cooperatively with others in a fairly small band to promote the likelihood of the survival of individuals, but also especially to increase the likelihood of the survival of other individuals in the band with whom one shares genes. Think about that as our primary adaptation, the primary source of the success of our ancestors. We nearly went extinct several times as a species, and our ancestors were forced to live in these very small little geographical islands, typically in the south of Africa, on a landmass of just probably several hundred square miles. Our entire species was gathered there. To stay alive under those conditions, our ancestors had to cooperate really, really well with each other. And part of that cooperation is giving in the moment without an immediate expectation of getting back. So that clearly has happened in our species. And one of the enabling conditions for that, that has enabled our species to be more altruistic, really, than any other sophisticated animal, is to know that your reputation is knowable and consequential. Otherwise, freeloaders will take advantage of altruistic individuals. So if you're a freeloader and somebody gives you a banana and nobody else is going to know whether you pay that person back tomorrow or the next week or next year, there's no incentive for you to pay them back. And in fact, it might reduce your likelihood of survival if you pay them back. On the other hand, if you know that the other members of the band are able to communicate effectively with each other and also have good memory for what actually happens, well, guess what? They're going to know if you just ripped off that generous individual and did not pay them back. And also, what developed is what's called altruistic punishment. In our ancestors' bands, people would go out of their way to punish freeloaders, including at some personal cost. And so for those two enabling conditions, one, the expectation that your freeloading actions will be known, and second, they'll matter. You know, there will be a price to pay eventually. That those conditions create a space in which altruism can evolve in humans unlike any other species on the planet. So that's a kind of fundamental way also of appreciating that, of course, we care about our reputation. And even if we evolve and practice the 12 strengths and meditate a lot, we're still going to naturally care about our reputation, what other people think about us. We have to hold that in perspective, obviously, but there's a reason why we care about that. So that's a probably a long-winded way of appreciating that we are naturally generous creatures. It's a very strong element in our psyche. The wolf of love fundamentally is much bigger and more powerful and diverse and multifaceted than the wolf of hate. And our opportunity now is to tap into this latent capacity for generosity and altruism and really develop it as a strength in our own life for the sake of others and also for the ways long term that through developing the strength of generosity, you'll act in ways that will come back to really benefit you as well.
Yeah, so speaking to that last bit at the end there, obviously generosity is good to others, and there are these kind of big picture ways where generosity can be good to us as well. As you were saying, you know, by giving to others eventually, whether karmically or just in kind of natural life course, often we receive good things in return. But what are some other kind of encouragements towards individual generosity? What are some ways that generosity is good for us just as it is good for others?
It feels good to give. Now, I want to be really clear. we don't want to, we overgive. I mean, if you, there's a term called pathological altruism. It's people who give too much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't really care for this term that much, but codependency sometimes is a way of talking about that, that we just put up with too much, or we're endlessly forgiving and don't really recognize that, you know, that tiger is actually not going to change its stripes on the one hand. On the other hand, generally speaking, it feels good to give. It feels good to give. Also, when you orient around generosity, even in a business environment of career, it kind of buoys you. It's inspiring. It brings energy. And other people start seeing you as someone who's a generous individual, and they, you know, develop goodwill for you. In long-term business environments where you're known over the years through reputation in your community or in your corporation, or in the marketplace in general, it's good to be known as a generous person. And that's another way it comes back to benefit you. And the last thing is that when you know in your heart that you're a giver, not a, you take, but net, you're oriented around really making sure you're doing your bit and you're really, really giving and you're showing up and, you know, holding up your end of the log. It moves you into, as we've talked about before, what the Buddha called the bliss of blamelessness. And there is a kind of bliss there where you put your head on your pillow at the end of the day and you know when you review your key relationships or you know your job or you reflect on the team you're part of, you just know, yeah, I really did my part. I did more than my part. And I can go to bed with a clean conscience, a clear conscience, and know in my heart that I really gave a lot today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I think that to make maybe one addition here, I think that most people, and this relates to the idea of making your offering that we had in the previous episode, have things inside of themselves that they want to contribute to the world and kind of want to give externally. And if they feel like there's not a vertical for them to give toward, that can actually be really, really harming to the sense of self and to self-image and to perceptions of self-worth and value. Because when we give to other people in some ways, and I don't, bringing this in kind of muddies the waters a little bit, I think, around just like the pure goodness of generosity, but just kind of take this for its face value rather than reading like super deeply into it. There is kind of an inherent power relationship that's created when you give to somebody else. Mm. Generally speaking, if you are a giver, it's because you have something to provide that the other person doesn't currently have. Now, most of the time, that's not a source of power, dominance, or whatever. You're just saying thank you. You're just, you know, letting somebody cut in front of you because you're being a good person, not because you're trying to demonstrate how you're better than them or whatever. Like, most of the time, it's totally fine. But my point in this is that if you feel like you just never have anything to give to anyone else, it's really easy for that to transition into a feeling of worthlessness and into a feeling like you're just not that useful human. And I think that most of us really want to feel useful and want to feel valuable. So that's another way where generosity can be a really powerful tool.
That seems so deep, Forrest. So true. I think for so many people, the real wound for them is thwarted giving, thwarted contributing. They feel like they've got a reservoir inside that's bottled up. And on any given day, maybe it doesn't look appropriate to give it. But over the long haul, it really starts to stagnate. And that reservoir starts to smell after a while. And it becomes very burdensome for people. Frankly, think back on some key relationships in which I felt nervous about offering what I had or giving what I had, which frankly sometimes was a kind of vulnerable statement about what I saw. Or on my part, it was a vulnerable wish to know what's going on inside this other person that I was living with or working with who just seemed really unhappy. And I held back the gift, if you will, the giving of even the question, the opening into greater closeness or connection that got held back. And I just think it's helpful for people to ask themselves, what are you holding back that would be really appropriate to give? maybe there's some risks with it. Maybe there's some ways you can max the odds that the gift will be well received, time and place, and setting the frame, setting the conditions, and so forth. But in your heart, is there something you know that you'd like to say or speak to in your relationships that would really serve for you to give?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to frame it. So with that acknowledgement of the value that can come to people from generosity, what are some of the blocks, whether psychologically or otherwise, that people often experience kind of on the road to giving those things to other people?
I think one is, I know it well, getting caught up in yourself. You know, becoming self-absorbed in trying to impress other people or being afraid of their criticism. Or maybe you just have a really strong internalized self-critic.
Yeah.
And you're always trying to perfect the offering. But you just, tangling yourself up in your own self-absorption rather than just taking a breath and make the offering, give what you've got to give, and they'll do what they do, but give it and move on. It's really interesting. One of the most successful people I know, you know who I'm talking about, his name Bob, and he's an extremely successful academic at the highest level and spectacular research career. And I asked him one time what he thought was the key to his success. But he said, you know, Rick, in the time it takes one other person to write a research paper, I've written three. And I just send them out. I don't feel like I've got to make them super duper perfect. And, you know, the odds are typically one comes back dead on arrival. One comes back with immediate acceptance. And one comes back with suggestions for improvement, which then I do. And at the point that somebody, and maybe other people, want to criticize my papers, a year later, their criticism comes in. But by that time, I've moved on to the next three papers I'm writing. And that's a real eye-opener, because I was definitely the guy who would obsess forever on perfecting the one great paper.
Yeah.
But instead, Bob would just move right on. So I think that's one block to cut through. Don't get too self-absorbed. Cut to the chase. Make the offering. See what the world wants and move on. That's one.
Yeah,
I think a second one that comes up is for people is this idea that, well, if it's not curing cancer, I shouldn't really offer it. It's not really good enough. And I've actually known a number of successful people who are doing a lot for the world, but deep down inside, they never feel like it's good enough. And that really holds them back from just offer what you've got. So the point is, it doesn't have to be the world's greatest thing. Hemingway had this really funny line. He said, write drunk, edit sober.
Yeah.
I think sometimes people write sober, as it were, way too much. And instead, they should just put it out, even if it's not the total package or the complete cure for everything. And I think that's a second major block to just being generous. And then the last thing is people underestimate the receptivity of others and the ways in which others would welcome their offering. Think about the number of times that you hemmed and hawed inside your mind or second-guessed yourself before you finally said something. And then you said it, and other people really liked it. Or maybe what you said was a little goofy or off or wrong or imperfect, and they kind of frowned slightly and then moved right on. And 5 minutes later, 5 hours later, no one remembered or cared about what it was you said. And if you rewind those moments and take them back in, you can often realize that the world is a lot more interested in what you have to give than you might think it is. And by seeing that, you can cut through the block of ignorance about the receptivity that's actually out there.
Yeah, that's great. To kind of forward that example of just chugging away, there was a story that I told in an earlier episode about making many pots versus making the perfect pot, where a teacher in class broke up the class into two groups, one that was tasked with producing as many clay pots as they could, one that was tasked with making one perfect clay pot. And by the end of the final project, it was actually the people who had just made as many as they could that ended up with the better single pot. And I think that there's something in that that's remarkably instructive around this whole idea of everyday giving, and also, again, referring to the previous episode on making your offering. So given that those blocks exist, what are some of the things that people can do or the ways that people can change their thinking that will allow them to start moving past those blocks?
I want to maybe offer two notions. This will be my offering, and you'll see if they're any good. One being, I would say, sort of concrete and practical. The other, fuzzier, but probably deeper and more far-reaching. The first is that, in terms of how can people work through these blocks, is to tap into what you and I have developed a lot in terms of our conversation, your inner encourager, your inner nurturer, that part of you that can guide you, that can build you up and move you forward, rather than tearing you down and hindering you and holding you back. And by tapping into that inner resource, that inner strength of self-guidance, self-encouragement, self-nurturance, you're going to be more able to move through these various blocks and kind of free yourself to be generous and to give. So I think that's true. The fuzzier, but I think potentially more far-reaching consideration has to do with the balance of compassion and equanimity. Mm-hmm. And this has to do with making our offering or giving what we can with regard to the suffering of others or the needs in the world. I think that people who are very moved by compassion can sometimes be overwhelmed by the needs of the world. Mm. There's so much pain. There's so many hungry children. Literally, frankly, over the duration of this podcast, some number greater than one of children in this planet have died of starvation. Mm. It's just so haunting to appreciate that. And yet, if we become really flooded with the feelings we have, with our compassion and a sense of helplessness, we can't do anything at all. And that gets in the way of giving what we do have to give. That's where equanimity comes in. Mm. We've talked about equanimity as inner balance, not reacting to your own reactions. In mm-hmm. other words, of course, it can feel overwhelming or upsetting or unpleasant to really, really face the needs and the suffering in this world. And yet we don't have to be overwhelmed by or capsized by those inner reactions to the suffering of the world. We can, through mindfulness and through some of the other strengths we develop in this podcast, and we can become more able to open our hearts to the sorrows of the world with enough equanimity inside ourselves that we're not disturbed by that and overwhelmed and disempowered and moved into helplessness. So that's where the two fit together. Compassion without equanimity gets overwhelmed and it's not very effective. Equanimity without compassion is too cool, too distant, too detached. That's why we have to bring both of them to bear. And when you have the equanimity, especially of wisdom, you know that on any given day, all you can do is what you can do. And if you exhaust yourself, if you fall into caregiver burnout or compassion fatigue, you just can't keep giving. So that's where equanimity and especially the equanimity of wisdom enables people to sustain the giving that is motivated and fueled by compassion over the long haul of a rich and full human life.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's a really powerful concept in general. To bring it kind of into the real world and use an example here, let's say that you are a person listening to this podcast who does tend to be more on the compassionate side of the spectrum and that you have a difficult time either interacting with the feelings of others or interacting with your own feelings sometimes or taking action around those feelings. Because when you start to touch them, they just kind of feel too hot. Yes. You know, they're too intense to manage. Of course, we've talked throughout this podcast of various ways to manage versions of that. But in this specific example of bringing more equanimity to it, what are some practices in the moment that a person can do to kind of increase their sense of equanimity or to settle themselves down or just kind of like bring themselves into a place where they can interact with that potentially very emotional material?
It's a very deep question and it's a work in progress for me. And it's here where I think it's really helpful to draw on people who clearly have evolved a lot in terms of both compassion and equanimity. I'm thinking of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail. Mm. Pema Chodron has really talked about this very deeply, When Things Fall Apart, one of her classic books. So I think drawing on people like that, or including people who are not famous, but you happen to know that they really exemplify that. I have a friend who's retiring now as a nurse, an ER nurse, and she to me is also someone who is able to really bring together compassion and equanimity. So that's one. Draw on the lessons of other people who are far down here. Second, recognize what you are giving. It can just seem overwhelming. The world is so large. Focus on what you actually are doing. Focus on what you are actually doing. That can really help support your own equanimity. Third, tune into your own body. Take care of your own body. Feel your own breathing. That will tend to turn up the gain, as it were, or the volume neurologically of the ways in which you'll be aware of your own ongoingness and your own internal states, and therefore it will simultaneously dial down the intensity of the world coming at you, which can help you feel less overwhelmed by it. So you tune into yourself, and you also take care of your own needs. Take those breaks. Look out the window. Have some sort of gallows humor, some sort of, you know, foxhole, in the foxhole together humor with the other people you're working with. Do whatever you need to do to take care of yourself and tune into yourself, and that'll help sustain the equanimity too. And then the last thing, I think, is to appreciate kind of the big picture. I have this wallpaper on my computer, so you've seen it probably. It's from the Deep Field photograph from the Hubble Space Telescope. And it's a picture of a little hole in the sky that's the size of a dime at 200 feet. And yet when light is drawn in through that tiny little pinhole in the sky, reaching back a billion or more light years, reaching out a billion or more light years, which means reaching back in time a billion or more years, in that single image are about 200 galaxies. So that can give us a kind of perspective. The Earth's been here a long time. There's been so much suffering, so much injustice, so many terrible things have happened. In a weird kind of way, recognizing that, while also recognizing there have been so many good efforts, there has been progress in a lot of different kinds of ways. Recognizing that big picture, I think, can really support equanimity, especially if that kind of works for you. And then, you know, last, it's a funny story. It's the starfish story. You've probably heard me tell it. Basically, two people are walking down a beach after a huge storm that has cast tens of thousands, maybe millions of little starfish up on the beach who are now dying in the sun. And as they walk along having their Sunday morning conversation, one of the two people periodically, about every third step in rhythm, reaches down, picks up a starfish, and flicks it back into the ocean. And after half an hour or so of this, the other person kind of bursts out with annoyance. What are you doing? It's a waste. You know, you're not changing anything whatsoever. You're making no difference here. And the other person, the one who's flicking the starfish back into the ocean, says, no, it makes all the difference in the world to the ones I throw back in. And paying attention to the ways in which you are having impact, and also paying attention to the ways in which others like you are having impact on the individuals that you really are helping, notwithstanding the so many you can't help. That too can support equanimity, which in turn can enable you to sustain the gift, the giving of compassion over the long haul.
I think that that's a really beautiful story and a great way to frame generosity in general. And I also think it's probably a good place to bring this episode to a close. So today we talked about everyday giving, which is the kind of day-to-day expression of generosity that just kind of creeps into the flow of normal life. We spoke for a minute about the evolution of generosity and why that sense of altruism is one of the kind of guiding features that makes humans humans and distinguishes them from other animals. We talked about ways to support that generosity and why it feels good to give, kind of ending with this example of somebody who feels stymied in their giving and therefore doesn't feel like a profoundly worthy and worthwhile person, and how that can kind of eat away at you over time. So we looked for ways to give and opportunities to give to others, whether in large ways or small. In that process of exploring opportunities for generosity, people can sometimes run into different blocks. We spoke about some of those blocks and focused kind of on a major one, this kind of sense of global dread, for lack of a better way of putting it. If the problems are so big, how can my small contributions possibly matter? And in response to that, you aired this idea of compassion and equanimity, which is where we ended the podcast, that in order for us to be truly generous, we have to both be compassionate to other people while also have enough equanimity to not be overwhelmed by their suffering. And it's in finding that balance that we can really use the strength of generosity to its fullest extent. So I think that that's the moment to bring this episode to a close. If you've been enjoying the podcast, I want to give one more reminder. We did in the last episode as well that right now there's an early bird registration available for Rick's Foundations of Wellbeing online program. It's what created the conceptual framework for both this podcast and our book Resilient. And I think that people, if you haven't checked it out, will really enjoy it. I'll drop a link to the program in the description of this episode as well. And we hope you'll join us again next week when we'll continue the strength of generosity with an episode focused on forgiveness. So until then, thanks for listening.